Hello and welcome to Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney in for Chris Nolte on this Monday edition of the show. We're continuing our conversation with members of Northwest Indiana's delegate legislation, and we have with us Chris Chung, the representative from Dyer in House District 15. Chris represents, is the ranking representative for the minority member of the local government committee. He's also a member of the following minority members of the local, ranking member of the minority local government committee. He's also a member of the following Indiana House committees: financial institutions, roads and transportations, and veterans affairs and public safety. Chung, born in Maryville and graduated from Munster High School, worked as a financial analyst for Pangea Real Estate in Chicago. Then he began his own real estate company, Co Holdings, in Hammond. Chung's volunteer work has included service with Habitat for Humanity Restore, as well as the Welcome Network. Representative Chung, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Did I get all the pronunciations, all the names correct?
Yeah, that sounded good to me.
All right, good deal. Well, let's get right into the conversation. A self-assessment on how year one went for you in 2019.
Yeah, well, it was an interesting session for sure, and definitely a learning experience, as I tell everybody who I meet who asks about the legislature. It's such a steep learning curve. You have to know about every topic that comes under the sun in terms of government, education, healthcare, road funding, the banking laws in this state as the member on Financial Institutions Committee, as you said. But overall, it was definitely a mixed bag in terms of where we ended, I believe. I don't think it was 100% good or 100% bad. There were some really good things that we passed, some really terrible bills that we killed, and then some that unfortunately, in our assessment, made it through. So I'm particularly proud of a few things that we were able to stop, including a payday lending bill, Senate Bill 613, that would have raised interest rates on working class Hoosiers, as well as weakened the felony loan sharking statute. And then also, we killed a moratorium on new green energy projects by the state of Indiana. And that would have been a bad financial move for a lot of people. Not only business and consumers might have seen their utility rates go up, but these new green energy projects might have been halted. At this point, they're becoming way more economical than some of the other older coal-fired plants. But we saw a big push from the coal industry to try and stop these new projects from coming online. But thankfully, we were able to stop that. So yeah, overall, a mixed bag.
Well, Chris, you definitely had your work cut out for you in terms of taking things over. One, I think the most interesting thing for me, especially because of you being sort of green behind the ears in terms of joining the House, House Bill 1140, and you are a co-author on it, and It got a reading, but transitions of newly elected officials requiring departments of local government's finances and departments of state boards of account to work with government associations to develop a checklist that describes for each elected office the information relating to that local office. And I guess talk with me about, because I guess, you know, election day's tomorrow for the local primaries, and I would assume that most voters would think, oh yeah, this person running for office knows how this office operates. That's not always the case, is it?
That's absolutely correct. So House Bill 1140 came to our Committee on Local Government, of which I'm the ranking minority member, and it was authored by Cherish Pryor, I believe, a state rep from Indianapolis. And she authored this bill mainly because there was a really unique issue in her area of the state where the former township a trustee, I believe it was, wouldn't give the incoming trustee the keys. And there wasn't a smooth transition of power by any means, and it was a bad thing that we never want to see happen. I mean, that should be illegal. So Cherish came back with this bill that would smooth that transition and at the same time put some training guardrails around it, because definitely people, and I can attest to this being in a completely new incoming role, I had to learn quite a bit in the last few weeks after the election about what the office does and how to effectively administer it as best I can, because I didn't have that institutional knowledge before not being a public official in my previous life. So it is definitely something that was well called for, passed out of the committee unanimously, I believe it was, and then just failed to make it across the finish line. So I believe we will come back with it next year. But we're optimistic about our hopes passing it in a less busy session next year where we don't have to deal with the budget.
Yeah, I think the budget obviously took up a lot of work, and we'll be getting to that here, at least that part of the conversation in just a few minutes. But some of the other stuff as well that that you worked on or that you were a co-author on as well, including Senate Bill 41, newborn screenings for health disorders, requiring at the beginning of July 1st, 2020, that newborns be examined for the detection of crab disease. Is it Pompe disease? Pompe disease?
I'm not sure exactly. I don't want to say. I'm not a physician.
and Hurler syndrome. So I'll be honest, three things that up until getting ready for the show today that I'd never heard about. But as a new father, I also like to think that, you know, yeah, health screenings for newborns or children who are in utero, probably a really good thing. What does this do for health care moving forward for the Hoosier State?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that bill was spearheaded mainly by Representative Doug Guttwein, who is a few districts south of me. And he really came with the first instance of crab disease with an individual, with a young child he knew, who actually ended up passing away right after the passage of that bill was signed by the governor. And mm-hmm. It was a very heartbreaking story. But we knew that in his passing that he is going to accomplish so much for kids in the state of Indiana by saving lives and mandating this new screening. You know, it was a bipartisan bill that everyone could get behind, and we're really proud of that. And a lot of people don't realize, actually, how often we pass legislation that is unanimous or bipartisan, because it'll feel like a lot of the media coverage is based on the 20% of bills that are super divided and partisan and get the most clicks and headline views. Mm-hmm. But in this instance, we were able to come together in a real bipartisan fashion, and I'm excited about the positive things we'll be able to do to reduce infant mortality in the state and expand this level of screening.
Yeah, and for infant mortality, I think, is one of those things across the state as a whole that I think Hoosiers would be relatively surprised at how high those numbers are.
We're eighth in the nation, yeah.
And especially here in Northwest Indiana, specifically in Lake County, the northern part of Lake County, a lot of issues with infant mortality mm-hmm. and children dying before their first birthday. So anything that we're seeing out of the State House obviously is a good thing to go ahead and curb those numbers. We got a couple of other things as well. We've got a bill on terrorism, including the offense of the use, possession, or manufacture of a weapon of mass destruction, agricultural terrorism, terroristic mischief, and terroristic deception as well. So a lot of things that sort of kind of realigns how the state of Indiana views terrorism. And so often people will hear comments being made by other members of the media, comments on social media, that when there's an attack, whether it's a shooting, whether it's some sort of a bombing or a vehicle or something, that, you know, this is an act of terrorism. But that's not always the case. And how does that sort of, I guess, jive with how Indiana now views terrorism?
So really, the bill was about bumping up the criminal code in certain areas. Mm-hmm. Mainly, it's who's going to be against fighting terrorism. So
right.
It was a pretty non-controversial bill in that aspect over a very interesting topic that is getting more and more salient in the press, for sure. So we are just making sure that we're communicating to Hoosiers that we hear their concerns. You know, we get calls to our offices about bill ideas, and I think Senator Freeman, the author of this bill, who when I co-sponsored, I spoke to him briefly about it, and I think it's one of those things that we just want to be responsive to the comments and public questions that the members in our districts bring to us about what they're concerned about. And you know, we're proud to be able to work with the Department of Homeland Security, the State Department of Homeland Security, and our local law enforcement as well to try and stop terrorism in any way that we can. So it was a unanimous bill in both chambers, and we're excited about it for sure.
We're talking with Chris Chung, representative of House District 15 here on Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney, filling in for Chris Nolte. Chris, you authored House Bill 1231, a ban on conversion therapy prohibiting mental health providers from engaging in conversion therapy with a patient less than 18 years of age and subjects a mental health provider who violates the prohibition to disciplinary action. Let's talk about that. I think that's going to be something that's probably going to be a bigger deal depending on how things shake out during the 2020 race with obviously Vice President Mike Pence, who's in favor of conversion therapy. We've got South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg on the Democratic ticket, who is staunchly against conversion therapy. Where does Indiana stand on that now, and what is this going to look like for the future?
Yeah, it's a really interesting two sides of the coin question with Pence and Mayor Pete on from the same state, but being kind of vastly different portrayals of our state. And it kind of represents, I think, how diverse the state of Indiana is in terms of viewpoints and in terms of political leanings. So with the conversion therapy bill, I do want to preface that we did author this bill with a lot of thought being put into it. We consulted a number of attorneys who saw the battles in other states. So we limited it to medical providers, not religious providers, because it was kind of a First Amendment minefield in California when they tried to ban religious facilities from engaging in this practice. So we thought, you know, we'll compromise and come halfway and at least ban medical providers, licensed medical professionals, psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists, and in fact, all of those national organizations for those healthcare groups have condemned this practice as pseudoscience and not real. So we feel that it makes sense for them to get behind this as well. The other part was that we limited it to 18 and under because we felt that it was difficult to regulate if you're an adult who wants to go and, you know, seek out this practice that doesn't have very much credibility at all. It would be very difficult for us to regulate your right against that. So at least, again, we'll compromise halfway was our thinking. And we decided to limit it to children who can't always don't always have the rights to speak for themselves. And unfortunately, the bill did not get a hearing in the Public Health Committee. I did speak with the chairwoman, Representative Cindy Kirkhofer from the Indianapolis area about the bill before before a session began. And, you know, she hadn't really indicated one way or another how she was feeling on the bill, but we felt that since there was such a debate around the hate crimes legislation happening in so many areas of the state, that this was kind of a parallel version of the law that we could use to expand the conversation for sure. And I got so many nice messages from people all over the state through my social media and to my legislative office that were just saying, you know, I'm so grateful that you're doing something like this because I live in a rural part of Indiana and I felt I wasn't seen until, you know, someone was demonstrating that they were caring about this issue that's becoming more and more prevalent. So we'll be back with it next year for sure. And we'll expand the discussion then as well.
And I, obviously, last but not least, you're thrown right into the fire with a budget session. And what was that like? Was it everything that you ever hoped it could be?
Well, it was very interesting for sure. There have been so many different versions of the budget floating around. As you can probably guess, it's an over 200-page bill that was constantly morphing into something new on the House side, on the Senate side, in committee and in conference committee, and based on whatever news of the day that people were reading as well. So all in all, in the end, I did vote against the budget. There were some really good things in there, for sure. I do want to preface that we were able to be, from what I understand, a lot more collaborative, both parties, than in previous sessions, in fact, with the new chairman of Ways and Means, Representative Todd Houston from Fishers, chairing that committee and being the architect of the budget, really. He was very receptive to meeting with all individuals, which, to his credit, was a good thing. We weren't able to get all the provisions we wanted in there, for sure. We didn't like the fact that K through 12 education was pegged at barely the rate of inflation, and it wasn't very much more. We have the lowest paid teachers in the Midwest, and we have a lot of budget crises that have been systemic and in place since 2008, since the Great Recession, really, that we haven't recovered from, even though we've collected a lot in taxpayer money to pad our budget surplus. Mm-hmm. So there's a balance there that I didn't think we were correctly striking on K through 12 education. But at the same time, we were able to negotiate for greater teacher appreciation grants to the tune from $30 million a year to $37.5 million a year, an additional $150 million for the 1996 Teacher Retirement Fund that would help pay down some teacher bond obligations for those retirement funds and theoretically free up more money for the school corporations to pay their own teachers or repair a school bus or repair an aging school building. Mm-hmm. So those were all important little victories. But all in all, we didn't see in the budget everything that we wanted. And then the other thing that's really relevant to Northwest Indiana in the budget is the South Shore double tracking and right. Westlake expansion projects. Now that, due to some changes in the federal law and what's happening in Washington, the state of Indiana decided to increase its upfront buy-in to $185 million with an option for $20 million more from the $12 million a year that it was. So we got a massive infusion of cash for the projects. But at the same time, we are shaking up the board and firing the current board of NICTI in the budget and installing gubernatorial appointees in their place. So that kind of, while we do get the additional money, we are losing the checks and balances piece.
Right.
And legally, this is considering being challenged by the LaPorte County commissioners. If you saw in the paper a few days ago that they are considering a court challenge because they really kind of pulled the rug out from under the current board members of NICTI. And we just want to have as much taxpayer accountability as possible. And I didn't believe that that could happen with five gubernatorial appointees in place of the 11-member board that has currently been functioning.
Chris, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us here on Regionally Speaking. Best of luck to you here in the shortened session coming up in the fall.
Thank you, Tom.
Welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney in for Chris Nolte on this Monday edition of the show. Joining us on the phone line now is Selena Weathermax of the Mack Foundation. Selena's also president of the McMillan Foundation. Selena, good afternoon.
Hello, good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us here. And a bit about the Mack Foundation. The McMillan Family Foundation Incorporated is a partnership with the Indiana District 1 Firefighter Training Council, established the multi-academic cooperative, the Mack Foundation, in order to better serve all public safety professionals. The Mack Foundation has been charged with developing training programs for firefighters, police, and EMS. And of course, the big news coming down the pipeline last week was the breaking of the ground of the new tactical training structure over by the Porter County Regional Airport in Valparaiso. And Selena, let's talk about that new training structure and what that means for first responders, what that means for public safety professionals here in Northwest Indiana.
Oh, absolutely. So the tactical training structure is a 4,200 a square foot building that essentially will be a building within a building. Law enforcement now has to oftentimes look for vacant homes or retail space in order to do proper training, specifically around search and rescue, you know, hostage scenarios, things to that effect. And so what we're doing now by building this this structure for them is that they can come in along with their vehicles and their entire units, come in and carry out the various scenarios that they would likely experience out in real life. And they can do so by, you know, removing the walls within the structure so they don't get used to, you know, consistency. And they can also monitor the different training that's taking effect in different positions of folks by video. So there'll be a recording of it, and they can review it afterwards in the classroom. So essentially, it's bringing live training within one site, and it's available to all first responders throughout Northwest Indiana. We are a regional nonprofit, and we train everyone at no cost to them or to their department.
So it's not just for Porter County, but it also includes Lake, LaPorte, Newton, Jasper, Stark, Pulaski, et cetera. Is that correct?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's correct.
And so you talk about that building within a building. And as I was reading up on the notes, I found this to be really interesting, really impressive, is the fact that you can take out walls, you can add walls, you can put in different stairways, you can create that sort of building within a building to give officers, to give SWAT teams, to give firefighters an opportunity to deal with what they deal with on a regular basis when it comes to an ever-evolving and ever-changing building landscape. Talk about the that committee that worked to go ahead and create this this building within a building.
So the law enforcement committee came together in the fall last year, and we started meeting on Friday to determine exactly the need and also to establish the priority of the different projects, right? Because the need is so great. I mean, to me, it's been mind-blowing to see how much need there is in terms of training for public safety, something that we don't think about, but these men and women crave it. They want to participate. They want to be active. They want to be better trained. They can go home to their families at the end of the evening. I mean, so we wanted to look to see, okay, what is it that is the priority need now? And the tactical training structure was at the forefront. And so they gathered on Fridays to determine what needed to go in that building. What did it need to look like? We started out thinking that it was going to cost about $180,000. Once we've incorporated all the ideas and suggestions, we're now pushing about $600,000.
But even then, $600,000 for this type of investment for training, no pun intended, it's a steal. I mean,
it really is. It really is. I'm glad you mentioned that, because we are doing everything that we can to be as cost effective as possible, because we are a nonprofit and because we are not wanting to charge people to come and train on our site. So yes, we're very mindful of that. We've hired Terry Larson with Larson Danielson Construction out of LaPorte, and they have generously donated all the project management time that's involved with this. So as you can imagine, that in itself is a huge cost savings to the MAC. And we've been able to also identify other partners throughout the region that have stepped up and will give. So I think that overall, to your point, $600,000 for this sort of facility is indeed a steal.
And breaking of the ground is going to happen here in the next couple of days, the next few weeks.
Actually, we broke ground formally on Friday morning we did.
Yeah, but I meant the actual, the actual construction portion of the building. Is that set to begin relatively soon then?
Yes. We were waiting for the weather to clear, and as you know, last week it didn't allow for that. So
a lot of rain last week.
Exactly. And so we're hoping that this week the construction crews can get started and have this opened up for first responders by the fall.
By the fall of this year?
Yes, September, October timeframe.
Wonderful. We wish you the best of luck, Selena, and thank you so much for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That was Selena Weatherwax of the MAC Foundation talking about the new police training, the Multi-Agency Academic Cooperative Emergency Services Training Campus. That's about to go under construction in Porter County. You're listening to Regionally Speaking. Welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney in for Chris Nolte on this Monday edition of the show. And I don't know how this guy got past security, but he's in the house nonetheless. Mitch Barloga of NICDE, the Northwest Indiana Regional Planning Commission, joining us here in the studio. Three region recreational trail projects are among 17 statewide that have earned grants through the state's new Next Level Trails program. The Pensee Greenway, Marquette Greenway, and Veterans Memorial Greenway will be extended as a result of the grants announced on Thursday of last week. Governor Eric Holcomb revealed $24.9 million in matching grants that will help develop 42 miles of new trails. From the Times, our growing network of trails is more than a recreational transportation amenity. It's an important tool for economic development by helping Indiana attract and retain the best workforce in the country. That's what Governor Eric Holcomb said. And of course, the man behind the trails,
yes.
Mitch Barloga. Mitch, good afternoon.
Thank you, Tom. Always glad to get by security.
We're thrilled that you got here, and let's talk about this new Next Levels Trails program. Three region trails here. Mm-hmm. Am I saying it right? The Pensee Greenway,
and then the Marquette Greenway, and the last one is Veterans Memorial Trail.
So let's start with the smallest one first, Veterans Memorial Trail, right, over in Hebron. Mm-hmm. That's going to be going from the west side of Hebron over into the Lake Porter County line at 231, just shy of $1 million, just shy of about a mile. Yeah. For those of you who aren't familiar, like myself, who aren't familiar with trails in that part of the area, which shame on me because I live right around the corner from there in Crown Point.
Deep shame.
Deep shame indeed. Let's talk about the development there on in South Lake County, where we don't typically think of trail development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is part of the Veterans Memorial Parkway vision altogether down there, the middle of Lake County into Porter County of the Veterans Memorial Parkway, and that's US 231 that was renamed as such. The trail itself goes from Crown Point to Hebron. It's along the old Pennsylvania Railroad line. It originally received funding in 1999. I mean, this is an old project. Mm-hmm. But the problem is it goes through rural territory and it cuts diagonally through there. And back in the 1800s, they did that stuff. Nowadays, it's a lot more complicated to reassemble land. Now, the original grant went from Crown Point to the Lake and Porter County line. This now takes it from that county line into downtown Hebron. Don Ensign, who is a councilman in Hebron, has been very active in making that happen. And it's a big win for them.
So up next then is the Marquette Greenway. Mm-hmm. As we move towards the big one with Pensy. But the Marquette Greenway is going to fill in a 1.5 mile gap at the Marquette Greenway in Burns Harbor. Mm-hmm. On a property that was donated by ArcelorMittal, a $1.7 million grant. So in taking that trail right now, am I subject to have to move off of the trail? Am I off-roading it for 1.5 miles?
Well, there's really nothing there now. And this gap is very critical in the sense of linking both east and west halves of the national park land right mm-hmm. now. It's always been this dividing area where you've had this kind of sliver of land that connects both, but it hasn't been publicly accessible, and the trail's going to make that happen. And then the Marquette Greenway itself is your major 58-mile initiative from South Chicago to New Buffalo, and mm-hmm. this is a huge part of that. So, and Burns Harbor, not a large community, not a lot of resources. Again, huge for them as well, as long with Hebron.
So what was the work like to get ArcelorMittal to donate that property?
Arcelor has been a great partner in developing not only trails, but just initiatives for conservation in general. And they've really been a great neighbor for the town of Burns Harbor. And I've had some great relations with them as well at NERPC. They actually helped fund some of the planning that we did some work with establishing water trails in this region about a decade ago. And so they continue to move forward with that.
And lastly is the Pensy Greenway. Mm-hmm. Almost $3 million in grants is going to help extend the Greenway by 2.3 miles from Roarman Park to Clark Road in Schererville. Schererville's partnering with Lake County Parks to complete the section under the larger Pensy system, which will connect Crown Point, Schererville, Munster, and Lansing over in the Illinois side. That's probably, I think, one of the bigger ones in terms of, you know, where a lot of foot traffic is on, or bike traffic, I should say, on a regular basis. Yeah, and foot.
Yeah, as Beth said these days, it's a bigly win for Schererville, because the Pensy itself, again, you have the Erie Lackawanna Trail that people are very familiar with that goes from Crown Point to Hammond, and then this one kind of dives off of it more in a northwestern. But this is going to be the route that the American Discovery Trail will follow, as well as the Great American Rail Trail from Washington, D.C. to Seattle. I mean, and getting this connected through Schererville at this point, it's a big victory for them. It's $2.9 million. It was the exact total. And you have some issues with some bridges over there. And again, there's some territory that isn't the easiest to traverse. So again, getting through this part and then getting Crown Point, hopefully, to apply for their finishing to the Erie Lackawanna Trail in the next mm-hmm. application, you'll have the completed Pensy then from Crown Point all the way through Lansing into Chicago and beyond.
So when are these expected to wrap?
Well, these projects are being funded with state money, which is great because it's not federal money, not nearly as many strings or hoops and ladders to go around. So they should be able to get these projects moving along and possibly finish by 2021, if not earlier.
So in the next year or two.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And then, so you talked about Crown Point with the next application process. What is that next application process for some of the cities and towns in Northwest Indiana with the trails that they're connected to?
And they're interested in that as well. We had 15 applications sent downstate. 3 got funded. And so you can imagine the competition is pretty fierce. Mm-hmm. And we're looking to have another application. I'm saying we, the DNR, that is,
yeah.
Department of Natural Resources, is probably within the next month or two is to get that out the door. And hopefully we can work with our local entities to kind of make their applications a lot more attractive for future funding.
So you're saying that there's more room to grow in Northwest Indiana.
There's plenty of room. I mean, yeah, our trail demand is extremely high. I mean, we just don't have enough money to satisfy the demand out there. But, you know, with the trail projects that got funded here, these are visionary projects in the state.
Yeah.
So, you know, along the American Discovery Trail and the Marquette Greenway. So that's what the state is focusing on right now. But there are some local projects that we also want to kind of bring to the top as well. So we're trying to be, you know, equitable in that type of assistance.
So let's talk. You mentioned earlier in the conversation a little bit about the waterways. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about those in Northwest Indiana. It is that time of the year.
Yes.
Maybe you're getting out on your stand-up paddle boards, kayaks.
Oh yeah, perfect.
Maybe it's your boats as you're traversing the waterways across Northwest Indiana. What's that like for the summer of 2019 for folks in the region?
Yeah, I think the best place that people can go to really find out what's happening is Northwest Indiana Paddling Association. It's an amazing group of individuals. There's like 500 members strong. They go out there. They have events all the time. I mean, they're on the Facebook. They're on the website. I mean, so people can readily find them. But, you know, we have a lot of routes in our region that are well-established. Kankakee River, Lake Michigan. You have your Little and Grand Calumet Rivers, of course. But then we're always trying to open up new ways. And, again, waterways are great because they're already there. Okay, you just have to get to them. We have to establish launches and places where they can put in their canoe, take out their canoe, and so forth. And, again, if people are interested in learning more about that, they can definitely go to the Northwest Indiana Paddling Facebook or website.
Question for you, and I guess maybe it doesn't apply to your role and what you're doing. Maybe it does. What type of an impact do you think having a national lakeshore on Lake Michigan have for paths and whether they be paved or waters across Northwest Indiana? Do you see that as any sort of an impact for you and what you're doing?
Well, it's a huge generator. I mean, people are coming here to visit the beach constantly. And, you know, you have 3-some million people a year visiting, you know, the Indiana Dunes. And so obviously that's going to be an attraction. But the fact that we have all of these trails that are opening up, they're easy to ride on, they're flat, they connect many communities together. There's a lot of destinations along the way. In fact, if you like beer, there's like 8 breweries around the year.
How'd you know?
I'm telling you, I just had this feeling. And you had one just open up next door here, I checked out. So, yeah, I mean, there's destinations galore, and we're having trails built throughout this region quite a bit. And so we have the visitors, they're coming through, they're discovering these systems, and they're, I guess the best word is, they're becoming enchanted with them. And they're like, well, this is great, because they ride in the Chicago area and they're too busy, there's a lot of congestion on these
systems.
They get here, there's not nearly as much, and you can travel quite a ways. I mean, 17 contiguous miles, Erie Lackawanna, 9 contiguous miles, Oak Savannah, and on and on. So, and of course, these are now all connecting up to the lakefront.
Right.
So people have that opportunity to kind of have a day trip to go up there, camp, come back, and do what have you. And people are starting to understand that and appreciate it.
Let's talk about the Northwest Indiana 2050, Connected, Renewed, United, and Vibrant.
Yes.
Where do we stand with 2050? What's happening, and where are we moving towards?
Yeah, 2050. So where I work at NERPC, Northwest Indiana Regional Planning, our core document is a 20-year transportation document, and we put this out, and we do it every 4 years. We have to have a 20-year horizon on it. That's why you see a 2050 on here, although it's 30 years by the time we renew it, anyway, so forth. We are asked by the federal government to make sure we have a 20-year horizon. So we are now in the process of approving this plan. We've had a very robust public participation process over the last year in putting it together. You know, we did our 2040 plan about a decade ago.
Yeah.
And out of that, we had some visions. We've taken those visions, and you know, we've had a completely new approach to this, where we take those 4 visions that you already mentioned, and I know them like my own middle name, and then we take those as chapter titles, then we grow those into goals, then we grow those into strategies, how to accomplish that, action items, performance measures, and the like. Very robust, very detailed document to try to get us to an optimum future achieving those 4 visions.
I was going to say, I think I've got an 8x16 sheet of paper.
It's about right. It's a ledger size. Yeah.
Folds up into a nice, wonderful pamphlet that's got a lot of the details. Obviously, the website, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, LinkedIn as well. Mm-hmm. And what types of I guess, community buy-in are you getting? Are you looking more for more individual support with 2050 moving forward? Have you capped out or maxed out on business and government support, or are you always looking for more of each?
Well, always more of each. You know, we're always trying to expand our reach into the region at all the private and public levels as possible. Of course, with a document like this, our main clients are the 41 communities, three counties and townships and the like that we have, and again, we don't have jurisdiction over them, but we collaborate with them, and we want to make sure that we're bringing the best planning ideals to light, that they can understand that, that we as an organization at NERPC can measure that, and then we can make sure that we are targeting the right stakeholders to accomplish these different types of goals to make sure that this future comes about. And of course, who can predict 30 years in the future? But
I think you could, Ryan.
Well,
I've got it right here.
We're trying to do
the pamphlet.
Well, we definitely demonstrate what a good future could be for the region, and we hope they buy into it at, you know, every private and public level in Northwest Indiana.
Well, I guess we'll have to stay tuned to 2050.
Exactly.
It's a good hook to go ahead and keep you around. Mitch Barloga from Northwest Indiana Regional Planning Commission, NICTI, talking about next level trails. Of course, the three trails here in Northwest Indiana that are going to be getting some added mileage. So make sure to get your bike tires pumped up and your hamstrings stretched out to go ahead and hit the pathways.
Or
I guess your legs and shoulders if you're hitting the water workouts this summer with the Northwest Indiana Paddling Commission.
Definitely.
And of course, NWI 2050. And Mitch, thanks so much for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll be back with Sam Barloga, Mitch's son, here in just a moment. Welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney in for Chris Nolte on this Monday edition of Regionally Speaking. And of course, tomorrow, if you don't already know, is primary election day here in Northwest Indiana. And we have the man, the myth, the legend, Sam Barloga in studio. Sam is a fixture on election night coverage, and I should note we will actually not have election night coverage tomorrow evening due to, Sam, if you'll believe this, but due to the hyperlocality of all of the races. It's actually really tough to find experts on all of the topics for all of the races who aren't newspaper reporters who are going to be out covering those races. So go ahead and make sure to check with the Times online. They'll be posting updates throughout the course of the evening as well as the next day. That'll be Wednesday. And, of course, listening to Morning Edition on Wednesday morning for those updates. But let's jump right into the thick of it. And for those of you who don't follow Sam on Twitter, Sam, what's your Twitter handle?
Just my name, at Sam Barloga.
Sam, all right. So if you go onto Twitter and you search for Sam Barloga, he's got a really fantastic 17-tweet thread. Is that what the kids call it these days?
Yeah, thread.
A thread. It starts off, of course, talking about the big races in Lake County. So Lake County, obviously looking at the Gary Democratic mayoral primary. East Chicago also has one as well. We just hosted a Gary debate last week. Six out of the nine candidates appeared on the stage. What do things look like for Gary Mayer and incumbent Karen Freeman Wilson, who's getting a lot of challengers on the Democratic side?
Yeah, so of course, you know, in a city like Gary, you see a lot of challengers a lot of times when it comes to something like the mayoral race. A lot of times, though, you don't have that many serious challengers because you have so many people file for the ballot. But this year, Lake County Assessor Jerome Prince really stands out as the key challenger to Karen Freeman Wilson. He's picked up the endorsement of the Northwest Indiana Times. That was about 2 months ago, back on March 10th. And he looks to have a lot of late momentum in that race. But, you know, incumbency is always a huge advantage, and would not put it past Freeman Wilson to win that race.
So it's going to be an uphill challenge nonetheless. And we've, of course, not only is there Jerome Prince, but there's Eddie Tarver Jr., who appeared on stage as well, and Levita Sparks Wade, who was, I will say this, as the moderator for that debate, came out with some pretty well, according to the crowd, pretty good zingers getting shots in at some of the candidates on the stage.
Yeah, she's really stood out as well. The third candidate there, Olivia Sparks-Wade, standing out in that debate and standing out in the race as a whole, being a city councilwoman, I believe, from the 6th District there in Gary. She's been around for a while, and she'll also be one to watch tomorrow night for that race.
Feet to the fire. Does Mayor Freeman Wilson win in what is ultimately the race for mayor, as there generally isn't a GOP candidate in the fall?
Yeah, actually, there's no Republicans filed for any office in Gary for tomorrow or the fall race. But, you know, it's going to be interesting to see with races this local and with races, you know, this close. It's hard to say prediction. You know, there's no public polls and there's no really state of the race. But incumbents always have a huge advantage, especially in a city like Gary. So it's going to be tough to knock her off. And I would put her in going into tomorrow as the slight favorite.
The last time we heard from the city of East Chicago, Anthony Copeland was running against six other people for an open seat in the EC mayoral race. And he's now being challenged by John Aguilera over in East Chicago. Of course, Copeland having to deal with the lead contamination crisis in the West Calumet housing complex for the better part of the last 3.5 years, give or take. What's that done for his candidacy and his job as mayor?
Yeah, so I think that this is going to be another really interesting race tomorrow because just like Jerome Prince being an elected official countywide, John Aguilera has a lot of really good name recognition going up against incumbent Mayor Anthony Copeland, being from East Chicago and representing that district in the State House that Mr. Aguilera did. So this is going to be a race to watch. Again, it's hard to decide who's going to win, but the good thing about East Chicago is that they have a high turnout for these types of municipal races, especially when compared to like midterm races. They like to come out for citywide elections.
Does that buck the trend in Northwest Indiana?
It bucks the trend certainly nationally, and it bucks the trend certainly statewide that a place would have higher municipal turnout than midterm turnout. I know back in 2014, some precincts in East Chicago had single-digit percentage turnout for that midterm. But then in 2015, it was above 20-30% in a lot of those precincts. So if that stays the same, then of course you're going to get higher turnout, and it's going to be hard to decide because both these politicians are well-known, and they're really good at getting their bases out to vote.
The other big race, obviously, there's a couple of big races in Porter County. We've got James Snyder, who was found guilty, he's been indicted in the tow truck scandal, obviously. Sue Lynch, who's a city councilwoman. Chris Stidham, who's the current clerk treasurer. And Andy Mileta, along with Leo Hedge Jr., are all on the ballot for the Democrats, who feel like they've got a pretty strong case to swing Portage blue, even though there is a GOP contention in the fall. What's that mayoral race shaping up to be like?
Yeah, it's a very interesting mayoral race because, you know, Portage historically for national and statewide races is a left-leaning community, a lot of union history in Portage. So Democratic-leaning, and it had a Republican mayor, of course, with James Snyder. So this is going to be a really interesting race. I do think that city councilwoman at large, Sue Lynch, is the slight favorite due to her previous electoral performances at city council at large in years past. But, you know, Stidham is young. He's got the endorsement of the Northwest Indiana Times. He's really trying to get more young people out to vote in this primary. And early voting turnout in Portage is really high. They've actually had a higher turnout for this municipal primary than they did for the Democratic primary last year already. So it's going to be one to watch, and it's really going to come down to what kind of voters come out. Lynch is better with, as the only female candidate, she should have an edge with women voters as well as some older voters that have been in the city for a while.
Now, this isn't in the tweet thread, but I will I'll ask it anyway and get your thoughts on probably the biggest race in Porter County, though, of course, is the mayor of Valparaiso. Bill Durnell is running against Deb Porter for the Democratic side. Matt Murphy is running unopposed on the GOP side. Durnell and Porter, Both both of individuals who in Northwest Indiana have a lot of name recognition, at least in Valparaiso.
Yeah, I think something that's been really interesting with this race, especially with Valparaiso having an early voting location in the city, turnout's been quite low. It's been lower than Portage, despite Valparaiso having a slightly higher population. And I think that's going to mean that which base can get their voters out tomorrow is going to be who wins this race. And also, how many Republicans kind of slide over to voting in the Democratic primary since there is no competitive race for the Republican mayoral?
It'll be interesting to watch. And again, early voting wraps up today, and your regular voting for the primaries tomorrow morning is, of course, at your general polling location. Mm-hmm. And if you're like me and you got moved, make sure that you have the updated and correct information on your polling location so you don't show up to the old one, and make sure that you bring your ticket with to prove that you've also been moved. And, of course, best of luck to all the candidates in their races tomorrow. And, of course, thanks to at Sam Barloga. So if you want the full 17 thread tweet about the local elections and the primary races tomorrow, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., primary races will begin. Check them out on Twitter. Sam, thanks for pinch hitting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pun intended, I suppose, with the White Sox hat, and rough weekend for the Southsiders going up against the Red Sox. But that's another conversation for another day. With another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Kirk Muspratt, music director and conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. Welcome back, Kirk.
Hi, John.
It's good to be with you, and we have reached the end of our 2018-19 concert season with the Northwest Indiana Symphony, and we have a spectacular final Pops concert of the season called One Small Step. Why don't you tell us about that theme?
Yes. Thank you, John. Well, as we know, it's the 50th anniversary of America doing that miraculous, groundbreaking thing in history, landing on the moon. And there's a wonderful, wonderful program that's available to orchestras called One Small Step. And what it is the music of Copland, Fanfare for the Common Man, and Copland, Appalachian Spring, while the video of all the engineering and the launches and the men in the spacecraft landing on the moon, all of those things goes on. So while you're watching that video, we're playing Copland with it. That's the second half of the program. So it's to celebrate the moon landing, really.
And you have some video and that sort of thing going on through the...
Yeah, the whole second half of the concert while we play Copland underneath it. It's all lined up. I have a click track that I line up, and it's all lined up. It's absolutely fascinating to watch.
Well, this is probably a great concert, not only for the sense of nostalgia of it being already 5 decades ago that this event took place, but there was a generation or more that didn't really have much of a focus on space, on the space program in the United States. We weren't as active, and we're very fortunate with this concert to have Jerry Ross, who is a former astronaut, an American hero, native of Crown Point, Indiana, who will be making an appearance. Why don't you talk about that a little bit, Kirk?
Yes, Jerry Ross, I was reading about him in the last week. He holds the record for the most spacewalks. He holds the record for the most launches from an astronaut. Just an astonishing guy. He went to Purdue, of course, from Crown Point. And he's agreed to come and attend the concert, greet people as they enter the concert. And then just before we start the second half, Jerry is going to come out and do about a 7-minute presentation on stage of photographs and slides that he's collected as an astronaut, talking about his work on the space shuttle, about the International Space Station, and also as an engineer, because he was a flight engineer, developing the things that the astronauts needed to survive and flourish.
That's going to be fun to have him on hand, a local celebrity.
Yeah, great. They say amazing guy, too. On the first half of the program, John, I just want to make sure I tell our audience that we're going to do bass music, So we'll do things like Zarathustra and Planet, and we're going to do Star Trek, Star Wars, some ET. We're going to do music from Apollo 13. The chorus is going to be there to sing pieces like Moon Glow, you know, anything to do with the moon and space travel. So the first half of the program is very fun. Lots of short, you know, 5-minute pieces like in the summer from, you know, outer space type scenes.
So this this is a great concert to bring young people to, for the reason that it gives them an exposure to the accomplishments of their country and of their country's space program and all those brave people and genius people who got us to the moon in 1969. It takes place on Friday, May 17th. It's going to be at Highland High School. And prior to the concert at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts next door in Munster, we're going to be having our all season long we have been asking people to join our Follow the Music Club, celebrating the 77th season of the symphony with a $77 contribution per person. And many, many people have. And for to reward those people, we're going to be having a party in the gallery at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts in conjunction with the 45th Annual Junior-Senior High School Show. We'll have Jeff Brown Trio, Jazz Trio playing. And we'll have food and beverages will be available, and we'll get you to the concert in time. So there's still time to join the Follow the Music Club with a $77 contribution per person to help support this current season that we're just concluding now with Symphony. So, Kirk, thanks a lot for being here to tell us about the concert that evening. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
That's host John Kane with Eye on the Arts, talking with Kirk Musbrack, conductor for the Northwest Indiana Symphony, about the upcoming performance of One Small Step on May 17th. You can hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Tune in next Monday for another edition of Eye on the Arts here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And thank you for listening to Regionally Speaking today. That does it for the show. I'm Tom Maloney filling in for Chris Nolte. Tomorrow we return with the Gary mayoral candidates debate aired in its entirety.